Let's call this meeting of the House Judiciary Committee to order. It is 1:08 p.m. on Friday, March 13, 2020. I have been asked to note that the minority members of this committee were the only ones on time today. I want to thank Jordan May, the House Judiciary Secretary, who makes sure we have a transcript of our meetings, and Madison Truitt from the Juno LIO, who makes sure we have sound. At this time, I want to remind committee members and all those in the room to please silence your cell phone. Present today, we have Representative Ledoux, Representative Drummond, Representative Stutes, Representative Shar, Representative Vance, and myself, Representative Klayman. We have a quorum to conduct business. Our first order of business today is House Bill 290, Alternative to Arrest Mental Health Centers, sponsored by my office. This is the third hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. At this time, I will take up amendments to House 290, and I'd like to put on the record in advance that Legislative Legal has permission to make any technical or conforming changes to the bill. Our office received two amendments to House Bill 290. Amendment process will be treated like floor amendments. The maker of the amendment moves the amendment and speaks to it with a three-minute limit. Then we'll take questions, and questions will be limited to 1 minute per question. Then we will proceed to discussion with each member limited to 3 minutes. Finally, the maker of the amendment will have 1 minute to wrap up. When we come to an amendment, the mover can either move the amendment or it will be withdrawn. We will not roll amendments to the bottom of the pile. Today, we'll begin with amendment number one. As I'm the sponsor, I believe, of both amendments, I'm going to pass the gavel to Representative Stutes for the duration of the amendment process. And with that, I will move amendment number one.
Object for purposes of discussion, Mr. Chair.
Representative Klayman, can you explain what amendment number one does, please?
Thank you. Amendment number one is a product of fairly extensive discussions with the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, and as well as law enforcement officers, and there was an interest in terms of the domestic violence context in which Section 2 of the bill arises, which is what this amendment addresses. And the concern was that if you have a domestic violence situation, that they wanted to limit circumstances when a person could be taken to a crisis stabilization when there is probable cause to arrest the person, to instances when the person is gravely disabled, consistent with the involuntary commitment requirements of Title 47. So what happens with Amendment 1 is, instead of a broader ability to divert when there is probable cause to arrest, the only circumstances when an officer could take somebody to a crisis stabilization center or an evaluation facility is if the officer had found that the person was basically subject for an involuntary commitment under Title 47, which is the provisions of AS 1225031B. And then the second part of Amendment Number 1, which relates to what happens when a police officer delivers a person to a crisis stabilization center, person who is subject to involuntary commitment, that whereas other provisions make it optional for the police officer to provide their contact information, in the specific instance of a domestic violence setting, the officer is required to provide their contact information to the evaluation center or the stabilization center. And if that person is at some point going to be released from the center, they have to notify, under the provisions of subsection D, they have to notify the officer, and then the peace officer would have to make reasonable efforts to notify the victim of the domestic violence of exactly what was happening at the crisis stabilization center or the emergency or the evaluation center. So that's what amendment number one does.
Do we have any questions for the maker of the amendment? Seeing none.
I remove my objection.
Would you like to wrap up, Representative Klayman?
No.
You removed your objection. The objection has been removed. I hear no other objection, so amendment number one has been adopted.
Madam Chair, I move amendment number two.
Object for purposes of discussion.
So the amendment number two is primarily cleanup language that's a product of Legislative Legal taking a look, and I think largely as a product of working through the process that was amendment number one, and they realized that on page 2, line number 1, which arises under subsection B of the alternative to arrest provisions, that rather than refer it just to a crisis stabilization center, they should make it either a crisis stabilization center or an evaluation facility. So this is a technical cleanup for clarity. And the other change on line 9, page 2, would, instead of saying provided the officer's contact information to the provider, it will now read provided the officer's contact information to the crisis stabilization center or evaluation facility. So this is, again, a cleanup and make the language of the statute or the bill more clear.
Are there any questions for the maker of amendment number 2? Seeing none,
I remove my objection.
Are there other objections? Seeing no other objections, amendment number 2 is adopted. And with that, I shall pass the gavel back to the chair.
Thank you, Representative Stutz. That brings the bill as amended back before the committee. I would actually like to ask the committee's indulgence that Carmen Lowry from the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault, I believe she's on the line. Is she still on the line? Actually, no, she's not on the line because she's walking in the door. So I know that Ms. Lowry actually wanted to make some public testimony with regard to the bill, and while you were walking up the hill, Ms. Lowry, we adopted both amendments, and they were approved unanimously by the committee. And if you want a moment to catch your breath, and then I'm going to reopen public testimony and give you a chance to testify on the bill. If there's anybody else in the room, I'll certainly allow them to testify, although it doesn't look like there's anyone else. So I'm going to go ahead and reopen public testimony. Ms. Lowry, do you need a minute, or are you ready? Okay. Welcome.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Carmen Lowry, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. I do apologize. I thought the building was closed, so I ran up very quickly. Thank you all for this opportunity.
Do you want us to take a minute so you can catch your breath? Let's go at ease until
you're
ready.
Thank you.
At ease. Back on record. The public testimony is still open. Ms. Lowry, now that you've had a chance to catch your breath.
Thank you very much. For the record, my name is Carmen Lowry, and I'm the Executive Director of the Council of the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. We are a membership-based organization comprised of 21 victim services organizations across the state. We are here to say that today we are in full support of HB 290 as it was amended today. Very, very grateful for Representative Klayman's leadership. We believe that the intent of this bill is really to decriminalize actions associated with individuals who experience an acute behavioral crisis and provide help for these people as opposed to arrest these people. We believe that this is supportive for families. We also would like to say and to thank the representative for allowing us to work with him to ensure that victim notification is present in this bill, and the amendments do that. We are always going to be looking at how might a victim be able to assert her or his rights, and we are thankful that the amendment allows that. Thank you very much, and I'm open to any questions if you have those.
I don't see any questions from members of the committee. Thank you for making the sprint up the hill.
Thank you.
And confirming that we are open and welcoming to the public. I don't see anyone else online for public testimony. Is there anyone in the room who would like to provide public testimony on House Bill 290? Hearing and seeing none, the public hearing is closed. And are there any further comments from members of the committee? Our practice is to limit those comments to 3 minutes, but does any committee member like to make any comments? Representative Vance, you look like you're on the verge. Representative Drummond, go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I had no idea that this was an issue before I heard this bill. It is a very good bill. It is responding to a critical issue in our state, and I hope we not only pass it out of this committee, but that it passes the other House as quickly as possible. That it, my understanding is that it will delay things tremendously if the legislature as a whole does not pass this bill. So I hope this committee passes it out and gets it over to the other side as soon as possible.
Thank you, Representative Drummond. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I agree that I believe that this bill is going in the right direction, but I do have reservations that we have not been given a fuller picture of what is going to come in the future as far as the need for more stabilization centers and the mobile units, and that's going to involve a lot of capital and more employees, which we see the obvious need, but I feel like we're being asked to take a tiny bite of a very large elephant, and I can foresee that we pass this as I believe it should be, but then next year we will see a larger chunk of the elephant, and the argument will be, where do we get the money? And then Hess will say, well, you gave us the permission to start this last year, now we need the money for it. And I would like to have a better idea on what we are going to need to make room for, because this is a high priority in our state. So I would just like as much information about the projections of this, of what this entails, in order to be able to fully and wholeheartedly support this bill at this time.
Thank you. I would note that Representative Kopp arrived just a couple of minutes ago. Any further comments in connection with House Bill 290? I will just note, as the sponsor of the legislation, that I want to thank the Department of Health and Human Services for their extensive work to get us here and the work with my office. I want to thank the Network on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. They can be quite tireless in their advocacy, but their tirelessness is reflected in their effectiveness as well. And I also want to thank the attorneys from the Department of Law who also participated. Mr. Wald, I'm not sure you're not, well, you've had your chance to. We don't need to hear more. So that, I just want to thank the members of the committee for hearing this bill, and I would encourage a yes vote. With that, Representative Kopp, are you ready to make a motion?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, I move version 31-LS1513-K of House Bill 290 as amended, with individual recommendations and attached fiscal laws.
Hearing and seeing no objection, House Bill 290 moves from committee. We're going to take a very brief at ease to get organized for the next bill. We're back on record, and when we last were hearing, I better read my script. This is the second hearing of our second order of business today, House Bill 287, Village Public Safety Officer Grant, sponsored by Representative Kopp. This is the second hearing of the bill in the House Judiciary Committee. Here to continue the bill presentation is Representative Kopp and his staff, Ken Truitt. Thank you for coming forward. If you'll identify yourselves for the record, and you can proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and committee members. For the record, my name is Chuck Kopp, House District Representative to District 24. I have with me my team member, Mr. Ken Truitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ken Truitt, for the record, staff to Representative Kopp. And I kind of played a dirty trick on you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee, with the length of the PowerPoint. It's really two PowerPoints. We covered the first PowerPoint at our last hearing, which was just an overview of the VPSO working group and the working group report. What follows in the presentation is both a sectional walk through the bill and also an explanation of changes that have been made to the bill in the prior committee. So there have been two versions of this bill, and you're looking at the third. So two prior versions. Version K was the bill that was introduced. Version G was the committee substitute that was adopted as a working document in the prior committee. And there were further amendments to that, which are reflected in the version that's before you, which is /O. So we'll just start off with the sectional. The slides that I have are really going to just, I'm going to be reading from the sectional that was provided as part of your bill packet. It corresponds to page and numbers of the bill. What gets shown on the screen will just be an explanation of the changes that were made as we went along. Is everybody with me on that? So starting right there on section 1 and section 2, section 1 on page 1, obviously, and section 2 goes into page 3 of the bill. These changes amend the criminal history of background checks there, and the sections 1 and sections 2 work together. Section 1 amends AS 1262-400. That's the statewide statute that any state agency that requests criminal background checks through the national system, they're placed in this statute, which is in section 1. Section 2 amends the Department of Public Safety's statute 1865-080 and places in that statute the obligation to conduct these background criminal background checks for the VPSO program.
And Mr. Chairman, for the record, Chuck Kopp. So reason why this is important is that at one point Department of Public Safety stopped doing the background checks for the VPS program and didn't give notice to the grantee organizations. So sections 1 and 2 make it clear that background checks are a Department of Public Safety function for the VPSO program.
So this is the first time we'll take a look at the screen. Section 3 repeals and reenacts the single VPSO statute. There's one VPSO statute.
Are you on the next slide?
I am. Well, there are several slides for this point, Mr. Chairman. So
go ahead. Sorry.
So one of the very first recommendation was to update the VPSO statute. There's one statute. This is from what you have on the screen is a chart, a comparison chart between the VPSO statute, which subsection A of the existing statute, and on the right side is a comparison to the state trooper duties from 1865-080. And so when we talk about the ambiguity of the VPSO statute, on the left is what we're really referring to, especially when you compare it to how specific the statutes are for the state troopers. So on the left, the VPSO duties, for anybody who's kind of a language nerd, there are six prepositional phrases before you get to that first bullet. That's the first actual duty of a VPSO officer. And when you compare that to, on the right, the state trooper duties, you can see right away the statutes don't mess around, and the state trooper's duties are very clear. This is why we're tightening this particular statute up. So,
yes, to reflect, for the record, this is Chuck Cobb. We're tightening it up to reflect what the duties actually are with the modern day Village Public Safety Officer is delivering in rural Alaska.
So this is Section 3 as it was introduced in version K. So you can see that we've added there online, and it's a digital snip of two different pages, so don't let the mismatched numbers on the left, line numbers, throw you off there. Just for the sake of putting it on one slide, we combined two different pages. And you can see that we've added all of the functions in one on line 4 there, number 2 on line 9. We've added everything that at the time that we were putting the bill draft together, the actual functions that these VPSO personnel are currently performing right now, and that's part of but when we moved to as it left the committee, you can see in the version that you'll have it's a little bit truncated because we did make some amendments. The prior committee made some amendments to this, to the duties, and that just made this statute a little bit too unwieldy, so the bill drafters decided to create a completely separate statute just dealing with the VPSO duties.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Drummond.
Questions okay?
Yes, please.
I'm unclear as to whether the VPSOs are currently providing all of these services, and this is simply enumerating those services, or is this adding services to what they're providing currently? And if so, it sounds like we're going to have to pay them more. I'm just slightly confused.
So through the chair, Representative Drummond, great question. So to your first point, there are more duties assigned here, but they are identified in statute according to what they have been doing for a long time. In other words, they have been performing outside the scope of their duty, necessarily so, and it has led to problems of grant monies being authorized to fund their public safety mission, because if you look at the statute, it says, well, it's not clear that you should be conducting investigations or enforcing the criminal laws, but in fact they are doing that, and their villages expect them to do it, and they are often doing it in the complete absence of other support from public safety. So by identified in statute, saying yes, this is part of your job function, it also helps us elevate this profession, which is what we want to do to improve recruitment and retention. I agree with you, we should be paying them more. We it's an appropriation each year from the legislature into the budget process. It's run as a grant program, but what we get out of that grant is pretty significant and for a non-state employee, non-benefited employee.
Okay. Just a follow-up.
Representative Drummond.
So this is in essence formalizing what they're currently doing in statute. Okay.
Through the chair, yes.
Okay, I'm good with that. Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
You can proceed.
For the record, Ken Truitt, staff for
Representative. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Shaw, he's on my list, and I just
Thank you. Was very neglectful.
I apologize, Representative Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Kappa, a concern that I have, and we talk about in this statute, development and dispersed through grants made under this section. And if I remember correctly, we're looking at probably in excess of 800 hours of training for a VPSO, excluding the firearms training that they will need to reach the level of certification. I have two questions. Basically, one, will they be certified at this level under Alaska Police Standards?
Through the chair, so the Village Public Safety Officer program is not certified by APSC. It's actually certified through DPS. They have their own regulations that certify. It's a separate category that's not under APSC.
I understand, but my question was, will they be at that level of certification that APSC would require of a certified police officer?
Through the chair, generally, yes. The academy length, the hours, very closely mirroring, like what an A-Lit academy would be. But it just, the legislature in its wisdom back in the 70s put it entirely under DPS.
Follow up?
Representative Shaw.
My follow-up question is the additional training that is going to have to take place to certify these VPSOs at this level, is that going to come from state funds, or is the grant program going to follow up on that?
Through the chair, so the grant funds would be additional training, but remember that most VPSOs get this training as far as basic criminal investigation right now as part of their basic VPSO training.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions. Let me proceed now.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Ken Truitt, staff for Representative Kopp. And I would note that I believe Captain Merrill is online and will be offering testimony, as well as Michael Newmuth from the Aleutian Pribilof Islands Association, who is a VPSO coordinator. Both of them are going to be subject matter experts on the details of the VPSO program, so they can also help clear up any of these questions when they are called upon to testify. So in the version that you have, this is very close. This is where on slide 17 now, where the version G moved all of these duties to the back of the bill, and we'll also get there later on in this presentation. But this shows the changes that were made in the prior committee. You can see on line 15, what was added in is that the language that a village public safety officer has the power of a peace officer of the state or a municipality. That language mirrors the trooper statute. And in existing and current law, both troopers and VPSO officers are in the definition of a peace officer. And so this language was requested to put in just so it mirrors the trooper statute and the trooper duties. Also, we've highlighted down on line 31 the powers usually and customarily exercised by a peace officer. That also is language that is currently in the state trooper statute, the duties. So we just wanted to make clear that very clear statement that VPSOs are law enforcement peace officers.
Representative Stutz has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sorry for the redundancy if you've already answered this. So will VPSOs have the same training as troopers?
Through the chair, Representative Stutz, VPSOs complete a substantially similar academy unless it is specifically identified as a truncated academy. It is possible to run through a shorter version, but in other words, that just defers some training until later in the field. But if they go through a normal full academy, which most of them do and have historically, they get substantially similar training.
Follow up.
Thank you. But is or is not, because I'm not very good at interpreting this section here, 1865-686, did I misunderstand you in saying that this is the same authority essentially that troopers will have?
Through the chair, we are upgrading their statutory authority so that there's nothing in the law that prevents them from doing a duty that another trooper would do if one was available to do that duty. The reason why that's important is because they are called upon routinely in some of the toughest areas of the state to be primary on-scene investigators. Sometimes they will be singly in charge of a crime scene for 2 days before a trooper can get there for everything from a homicide to a sexual assault. So we want to, and the reason why this is important is if you don't identify the function in statute, it's hard to justify sending them to training for this. So the statute has to be in place to say, yeah, this is part of what you do, and then it also makes it easier, logically follows that we're going to authorize training to be able to do that.
Okay. I mean, I hear what you're saying. Follow up. I hear what you're saying. I guess it's just a little bit confusing for me, but I can see the purpose of it to encourage,
Mr. Chairman,
the same training. Okay, gotcha. Thank you.
Okay, Representative Ledoux.
Why not just make them troopers? Why go through all of this? Why not just make them troopers?
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, first of all, the state of Alaska does not have enough money to hire the hundreds of more state troopers that we need. I personally am all for state troopers. We can't imagine the value of the dollar the state has working with local tribal governments, local entities who are have established nonprofits to partner with the state, having you know no state benefited employees, not driving up the pension costs and things like that. It's a question of, do we want to throw $50, $60, $70, $80 million at it, or do we want to improve a program that right now is costing the state about $11 million a year, with about $8.5 million actually going to the grantees themselves and the other part for administration of DPS. It is an example of local government providing local solutions to public safety, and it's easy for us to underestimate how powerful the communities are committed to this Village Public Safety Officer program. It would be maybe how you live in Anchorage. It would be how the city of Anchorage would feel if you said, why don't we just have troopers police Anchorage? Or a better example would be any small town in Alaska that has their own Palmer Police Department, Wasilla Police Department, Kenai, Soldotna. Communities and community councils want control of their own public safety. And the grantees are no different. They represent communities who see their VPSO as local public safety solution, and the state gets a tremendous value out of that in cost savings. So it's a critical partnership, throwing more troopers. And remember, we also would have to provide the housing and the infrastructure and the support for the troopers. In many of these areas are such tough places to live that there is no place to put a trooper. We could hire more troopers, we'd still have to fly them in there. And it's hard to get young troopers with families to want to move into these areas. You know, it doesn't happen. So there's many reasons why we need this VPSO program to be successful, because it's the boots on the ground doing the job for Alaskans.
Representative Ledoux, you have a follow-up. Go ahead.
Yeah, I guess I'm thinking about, and I don't necessarily think that this is the best of all possible worlds, but Barrow or Ugiagit wanted a prosecutor. So Barrow's paying for that prosecutor. So wouldn't it be possible to have, so right now you've got this Village Public Safety Officer program, but if you installed troopers, wouldn't it be possible for some of the same entities that are paying for those Village Public Safety Officers through this grant program and then other grants, I guess, that they're getting to pay it like that? I mean, it just sort of seems like if they get the same training and they're doing the same things, that maybe they are troopers. I don't know.
So, I don't want to confuse short-term goals with long-term goals. Long-term, we want to raise the status and the profession of what these brave men and women do in rural Alaska every day. Short term, what you have asked is just about impossible, because first of all, it's hard to appreciate what the financial contribution already is for the grantees with the VPSO. They're just not the recipients of a free grant. They have a massive financial commitment through indirect costs to support the program. They get their labor paid for. The VPSO is about, what do they get, $20 an hour? I mean, it's not even minimum wage from where they're at working in Alaska. And so the grantees, they have to come up with the housing, with the IT, the HR, all the infrastructure to support this peace officer. And that's not at any cost to the state. So for them to partner with the state, it would be considerably more investment to get that same resource, because now you're talking a state-benefited employee who just costs a lot more, frankly. And I go back to the value of what we're getting and how committed the grantees are to provide infrastructure for the VPSOs in their community. Could they partner with the state for a trooper? Yeah, but the difference is you won't get a trooper to live there. It just won't happen. We already, our troopers, number one, they are intentionally deployed out of major hubs because they have to be able to be more flexible. But we are talking small villages, very rural communities, where the VPSOs are also the fire chiefs. They're the fire chiefs. They're the head emergency trauma technician. They're the first person to go to for search and rescue. And their phone goes off all the time. They do it all, but they're in areas where we just can't. There is no other model that Alaska has practiced that works, but this is a uniquely Alaskan model that with the proper support, the communities from going out in them and taking testimony, they strongly believe in it, and they feel with proper support it could really prosper. Thank you for the question. Yeah.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kopp, remind me, I'm unclear as to when and whether the legislature authorized VPSOs to carry firearms and also to receive training at the Trooper Academy for those firearms. And is that included in the powers usually and customarily exercised by a police officer?
Through the chair, thank you, Representative Drummond. So you're right, it was about 6 years ago that legislation was passed. I forget if it was Representative Edgman's bill. I think it was. And, of course, you know, we're all familiar with the killing of VPSO Thomas Madoli in Manicotic, an unarmed VPSO who was going to a gun call and got shot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it was just public outrage that, you know, why do we have VPSOs in the toughest spots going to very violent situations where there is no trooper to go to and not have at least the grantees have the authority to arm them if they want to put them through the training. It didn't prescribe that they had to arm them. It just made sure there was nothing in the law to prevent that if they were properly trained and certified.
Representative Drummond.
So does this bill enumerate that or reinforce that?
Through the chair, yes. Yes. Okay. We'll get to it more. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Representative Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Kopp, can you highlight for the committee the oversight and regulatory authority for the VPSOs, and then I'll have a follow-up.
Representative Shaw, so that's coming up shortly in the bill. Okay. I could skip sections and get to that, but
that's fine.
Okay.
And then
follow-up?
Yeah, follow-up would be training and standards. You highlighted earlier that they do not fall under the standards of Alaska Police Standards Council, but their training is equivalent to potentially at the level of a trooper, but the standards are not equivalent, and so that's a concern that I have. If you want to elaborate on that, or if it's another slide later,
we're actually getting to that very issue coming up. But those are great questions, Representative Shaw. We'll get to them.
I do have one question. You, in a follow-up on Representative Drummond's about the armed VPSOs, hasn't it been the case that even though they're allowed to be armed, to be armed, they have to go through additional training, and in fact, a very small number of VPSOs have taken the training to be armed. And my memory, but it may be a couple of years old, was that if you actually took a census, we at most have one or two armed VPSOs in the state today, and the remainder of them are not. I'm not sure licensed is the right word, but they haven't done the training required to be able to be armed.
To the chair, not through the chair, Representative Klayman. So you are correct that only a very few number of VPSOs are actually armed, and that is because, as you point out, the additional training required, and there's also ongoing training for just what's appropriate use of force, shoot, don't shoot. There's a lot of training. Some grantees are willing to invest that heavily, and for other grantees, it can also be liability. Do they want the liability? So, again, the legislature has not been prescriptive. We're not telling them what to do, but we're making sure the law doesn't prohibit them if they want to offer that level of training from doing that.
Okay. Thank you. Okay. You can proceed. I would know we're coming up on two, and at some point we may hold questions so they can get through their slide presentation. I think we have 12 people online, some of whom are here for questions, some to provide public testimony, but I would like to get to those folks today. So. Please proceed.
All right. So going going to just the bill itself, subsection A, which is on page 3-4. This is important because this is the provision where, and it's not on the screen, it will be on your statute that's in front of you. So the screen is really for explanation of changes. So subsection A has been rewritten, and this is where we start with splitting grant management from the Department of Public Safety to the Department of Commerce. Page 3, I'm talking of subsection A of AS 1865-670, the repealed and reenacted VPSO statute. And it goes on to page 4. Subsection B, now on page 4, is mostly similar to the existing subsection B of 1865-670, but it's been updated to include references to the Commissioner of Commerce. It includes federally recognized tribes as organizations that can be awarded a VPSO grant. And just as a heads up, we're thinking that we might be offering an amendment to remove this.
Let's just go forward with what we have now. We don't need to worry about the amendments.
Subsection C, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Subsection C, page 4, line 16, is the new statutory codification of current Department of Public Safety Regulation 13 AAC 96020, with changes to reflect that the Department of Commerce will be performing financial management of the grants. Our next change is on subsection D, page 426. This is the statutory codification of the DPS regulation 13 AAC 96030 with changes to reflect that DECD will be forming financial management of the grants. I might be, I've got that. Yeah.
Let me jump in here.
Mr. Chairman, this section this is Chuck Kopp for the record. Basically, what we're doing here is we're putting the financial management under Commerce. That's a fundamental change rather than DPS. DPS is not a grants management agency. Commerce is. They partner with all of our nonprofits on managing grants, but they need to stay operationally in oversight, and the mentorship, training, and support they provide is critical. But we found that there was a real conflict in talking with all 10 of the grantees and the communities, that for DPS to have both the money piece and the operational piece, it ended up being a mission collision, because they were making decisions on funding or not funding training or activities based on a very literal view of the law, which was too restricted, and that's why we are growing it to show what the VPSOs actually do in carrying out the law, so that funding can be adequately directed to support those public safety activities. Commerce is prepared and able to administer these grants, and it is something that they routinely do. Subsection E is the new partial codification of current DPS regulations. Again, this is current regulations, and it sets the overall policy that one VPSO is generally assigned to one village unless the organization requests additional VPSO personnel village. And the other thing we're doing here, Mr. Chair, in subsection F is allowing for traveling or roving VPSOs. One of the challenges is previously grant language made it so that you could not have your VPSO go to another village nearby that needed help because your VPSO was hired for that village. And so it just didn't make sense. Public safety needs to be able to respond to nearby locations. We're making it clear that the grantees have the authority to provide this roving support. Subsection G also goes right into Commerce performing the financial management of the grants again, and contains grant award record keeping requirements and just grant management requirements consistent with recommendations 1, 2, and 9 of this report. Subsection H is word for word existing from current law. No new changes there. Subsection I allows for funding grantee organizations indirect rates up to a statewide average of 35%. This language has been used as intent language in multiple prior operating budget bills. So we're not doing something new there as far as the state's concerned. That's generally where we set it at. And this is to implement recommendations 2, 4, and 5, which are in your packet as far as the 9 overall recommendations from the committee. Subsection J is new and provides explicit instruction to the Commerce Commissioner on grant fund disbursement. In other words, funds can be used for items reasonably related to public safety and VPSO duties as identified in the bill. And that grant funds are not to be unreasonably withheld and timely dispersed. This is just getting to the recommendation two. Subsection K and L are related to new prior to new items in H, and provides for a consultation process with grantees before making new regulations. In other words, we're not going to surprise you. We're actually going to come. The 10 grantees operate as a council. So before we dramatically change the regulations in the program, we're going to go talk to you first before we change the rules, whether it's your certification requirements, your hiring requirements, things that they need to know as grantees. They are partners with the state in providing public safety service that we otherwise would have to do. All they've asked us to do is talk to us first before you dramatically change the program. So we seem that seemed to be pretty reasonable. We put that here in this bill. Section 4 gets into the new statutes, where we are looking at the codification of regulations dealing with VPSO qualification requirements. And so we go right down through there. We see the VPSO background checks, what's required. The slide in front of you identifies for background. You cannot have been convicted of any felony crime against a person, or, and B there, it's any felony sex crime that you can never have been convicted of. And if it's another felony, so no felony sex crimes, no felonies against a person, but where we put some latitude is in some people may have had a drug possession felony, which is no longer a felony. Maybe you got caught, you know, with some drug that is now a misdemeanor possession offense. We've changed our laws over the last several years, and this would say that if you are 10 years of no offenses, it would give DPS an opportunity to, in their background investigation, to make query of the person, see if they can get a waiver. They would still have to get a waiver for them to access criminal justice information services, but it also enables communities to more identify people who come out of very difficult communities where domestic violence, sexual assault, substance abuse is very high, and it's remarkable when you get young men and women come out of that unscathed. So maybe they didn't come out unscathed. If they have something that's not one of these disqualifiers, it allows more room for DPS to seek approval or grant approval for a person to serve as a VPSO officer. Under the domestic violence section, we took that word for word out of current regulation, which is you can't have had a DV crime within 10 years. Go ahead.
Sure. And for the record, Ken Truitt, staff representative COP, slide 28 shows how this section was changed while it was in the prior committee. You can see the addition of sex offenses to a prohibition on line 5, subparagraph C shows a carve out, but felonies under A and B, the crimes against the person, and sex offenses will always be bars to being qualified. And it shows on line 8 the option that a program can apply to the Department of Public Safety for a grant of a waiver that will allow an individual to access the criminal justice information systems, which otherwise they are barred from because of these prior convictions. And so you can see with this change that we're showing you, this on the misdemeanor crimes, we also, when this was
we're on page 30,
slide 30, shows the with the we got a letter from the Department of Public Safety asking us to include what's highlighted showing on lines 12, which is again it's a waiver. You have to apply for a waiver to access the CJIS systems to the Department of Public Safety if you've got one of these misdemeanor domestic violence crimes.
Representative Ledoux.
I don't know what it means when it says it grants a waiver allowing the individual to access the criminal justice information system.
Through the chair, so Representative Ledoux, reports are now filed directly by the public safety officer. So if they are to access information in CJIS, that would include the National Crime Information Center, the Alaska Public Safety Information Network. These are the law enforcement databases to where you run somebody for wants and warrants, or you're pulling up their basic person history so you can fill out a report form. That all is, you have to have background clearance to have access to. The Criminal Justice Information System is just a general term for those specific databases that they have access to in getting information for reports and finding out if someone is wanted or not, or other sensitive public safety data.
And so, Representative Ledoux, I think another way to look at it is that the state's access to criminal history data is actually specific to the state. Well, the federal government has it too, but for our purposes, the state are the only people that really have access to it. And so when you actually have a non-state entity in these instances, that the native governance groups that are running the VPSO programs, they actually have to have permission to be able to get access to somebody's criminal history. So to get the background, they basically have to get, the person that has the background has to agree to let them see it. And that's, I think, what this is, an agreement that basically says, I'm applying for the job and you can look at my background, effectively.
No, that's not what it says.
Isn't that what it is in practice, Representative Copper, have I got that wrong?
Well, you're a little bit right, Mr. Chair, and great difference.
Representative
Ledoux is asking a separate question. She's looking at the qualifications that you're going through, or the disqualifiers, and that none of those disqualifiers would prohibit you from getting access to the system. And I think she's just acknowledging that DPS would have authority to grant a waiver. Now, DPS can't do it if our federal partners who control, like the National Criminal Information System, NCIC, if they say, no, you can't have a waiver, then DPS just can't give a waiver. So this is not just to put them in the hot seat of saying yes or no, but there has to be an entity who coordinates with federal database partners to either advocate for a waiver and find out if one can be gained or not. We did learn recently from DPS that the federal government has just added more breathing room, that other than standard disqualifiers, if you can show there's extraordinary circumstances apply where you need a waiver. Certainly we've had the Attorney General of the United States declare a rural public safety crisis in rural Alaska, and some of these communities have identified people that the elders and the leaders of the community really value and trust, that they may have something on their record that is, let's say it's a 11 or 12 year old DV offense. And remember, a domestic violence offense, including a no contact order where you're told you can't pick up the phone and call someone, but that is a former partner or someone you were living with, or you could have been in a fight with your brother or sister. Those are domestic violence crimes. And this would say that if those are outside of the 10-year bracket, if they can get you a waiver to access the system, then you can be. But if they can't get a waiver, then, you know, you're going to have somebody else make the query that is qualified, or you personally would not be able to do it.
So, follow-up?
Representative will do follow-up.
So do I understand that what you're saying is that the village public safety officer has got to be able to access this criminal justice data system? And so normally people who have any crimes aren't allowed to access the data system. And so this is the public safety department granting a waiver, allowing those individuals who normally wouldn't get to access data, now they can access the data. Am I correct?
So through the chair, you are right on, except for you're missing a big important point.
Okay.
Is that already public safety gets waivers for people that they have to get waivers for, because on the face, they could be determined to be invalid. But they will do that for their own clerks, record keepers, people who have access to this information. This is not an unusual thing. In other words, you if you have a complete disqualifier, let's say you're outside of the parameters of this bill, they can't get you a waiver. But if you're in something that has a time bar limits, then it is possible for them to request. So this is something that goes on now.
So,
follow up.
I may be just nitpicking, but why wouldn't this, and the Department of Public Safety grants a waiver, why wouldn't that be under C, too?
I think it is.
Oh, it does. It is. It's just you've added it to D. I think I get this now. Okay, thanks.
Okay, thank you, Representative Hill.
Please proceed.
This slide just slide 32 for the record, Ken Truitt. This just reflects another change to the same qualifications statute, page 9 and 10. This is just an oversight in the drafting. We had three or more misdemeanor operating the vehicle while under the influence of alcohol. It's two. It was meant to be two, but there was just an oversight. 676 more qualifications, and this was also on slide 33 is a technical change. The prior versions used the word use. The proper term under the statutes is possession of a controlled substance. So that's just a technical change. Getting to background investigations, this particular on 1865-674, which is on page 9 and 10, this clarifies that DPS is doing the criminal background checks for the VPSO officers, but in adding the Department of Commerce into this program, in the bill draft it got added in some ways that were unintentional, and adding the Department of Commerce into the background check process was one of those. So these next few slides just show that in the prior version we're taking the Department of Commerce out of the task of doing criminal background checks, and it is remaining a Department of Public Safety function and task for this program. So this is just in the next section of the statute, the Department of Commerce is coming out. And this is where we're getting now, slide 36, into the training requirements, which is statute 1865, proposed statute 1865-676, and this might be where some of your specific questions on training can be answered. So this just reflects 826 hours, 650 of which is in law enforcement, and these are the topics that will be covered there. In the prior version of the bill, we had very specific hour requirements for the emergency and trauma technician training, search and rescue training, and rural fire protection specialist training. The version that you have, those specific hours were removed, and just a kind of a global hour requirement of training in those topics was inserted instead.
Representative Stutes has a question.
I just have a quick question. Thank you, through the chair. So back on slide 37, yeah, on the hours. So are these hours that will be required prior to the individual becoming a VPSO, or are these hours that you can have them on the job and then they get the training, yeah, but they have... Yeah. Where's the cutoff?
Yeah, through the chair. Great question, Representative Ledoux. So these would be hours to be certified.
It's Representative Stutes.
Oh, I'm sorry. What did I say?
I'm usually the only one that can't keep track.
Representative Stutes, yeah. Hours to be certified. And this gets to Representative Shaw's question earlier under training. This sets the minimum standards for certification by DPS. Now, the bill recognizes there's a 24-month period to be certified. Some of it, remember, a VPSO has much broader duties than a normal trooper. They serve as the fire chief in their communities. They serve as, a lot of them have much more extensive medical training, just because they're the first responder for any medical trauma. So it can take a while for all those certifications to go. And so the VPSO programs have a very good intermediate time where their VPSO can be hired, be doing a lot of non-law enforcement duties, because there's so many non-law enforcement duties they need to be trained up on. So 24 months gives them a chance to do all that, plus go through all the basic training for their physical methods of arrest, you know, use of weapons, defensive weapons, and then the hours of the program are listed there, and that's all your criminal procedure law, everything to do with doing the job, and domestic violence, sexual assault prevention response procedures. So it's very involved, and they have that time period. Once they're done, then they're certified. But they can be hired before all that's done.
Follow-up, Representative Stutz.
Thank you, through the chair. So, and I heard you say they have 24 months to do this. So on month 25, if they haven't completed this, they're out. Is that right? Is that correct?
I would, through the chair, Representative Stutz, I would probably let the grantees, I believe that they could get an extension through DPS again, but I'm not positive how that works if they run up hard against a time wall. So.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Representative Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Okay, Representative Kopp, this comes back to my initial question relative to oversight and regulatory authority. You had highlighted earlier that they do not come under the regulatory authority of Alaska Police Standards, but they are meeting a minimum amount of hours for certification. So my question goes back again to the oversight and regulatory authority relative to the certification of training that they have had for the committee's benefit.
Through the chair, for the record, Ken Truitt, staff for Representative Kopp. Through the chair, Representative Shaw. I'm staff to Representative Kopp.
You know, there's the only rule is the only person that's allowed to get names confused is the chair.
Just say Representative.
Who
this
are
is
you?
Representative again? Shaw here.
Yes.
Got my question.
Through the chair, Representative Shaw. Certification has always been with the Department of Public Safety, specifically outside of the Alaska Police Standards Council. What this bill seeks to do is put into statute the certification requirements that have been in regulation of the Department of Public Safety. I think whether the VPSO program should or will or could be under the Police Standards Council is more of a long-term issue. The purpose of this bill is to just get something that can help improve the program right away. But the as I understand it, the Police Standards Council is also with under the Department of Public Safety. But this housed there, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Follow up?
And there are certification provisions in the statute that are coming up in the bill.
Mm-hmm. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What amount of training does a VPSO have when they enter the field?
Through the chair, Representative Vance, it depends on if they have reached full certification status or not. But if they have not, the program, just like a field trained officer program for a police officer, generally a police officer is not quite worthless, but close to it for the first 2 years on the job. There's a lot of training that's ongoing into making them where they can function independently without immediate oversight. And I don't say that facetiously. I mean, we joke about it in public safety, but sometimes your partner who's new on the job is the most dangerous person in the room to know just enough to get you in trouble. So it's no different with the VPSO. So what you do is you structure what they're exposed to and what they're allowed to do by what they're actually trained to do and ready to face. So that's part of what the grantees do is they put them through a lot of training that it will enable them to do what that community needs right then. It may be that their biggest thing is they need their fire chief operational. So they're going to get their firefighter 1, 2, 3 certifications. They're going to go through all that, and then maybe they'll be focused on the medical training, and then maybe towards the end of the program they get into the real law enforcement specific. But they are truly a jack of all trades, but they don't go out and execute duties until they've had their training. Now, like any member of the community, you can be called to act in a crisis outside the scope of what you know, but you're a community member and you're gonna do what's necessary. But as a rule, they stay within the confines of what they know. And 24 months is very important because of the remoteness of these locations and getting them in and out of areas to get their training. It just takes time. Thank you.
You may proceed. And I would know we're almost at 2:15. I'm going to give you about 5 more minutes on your presentation. Then I think we're going to go to the public hearing, and then we can come back and conclude the presentation. But I have people that have been waiting for more than an hour to testify, and I want to give them a chance to have their say.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We can go very quickly here. Page 11 of the bill is the proposed statute 1865-678 is the codification of the firearms training. This is a regulation that's currently in effect in the Department of Public Safety, and we're just putting that into statute. Page 12 and 13 is proposed AS 1865-682 is the statutory codification of current regulation dealing with certification. So for Representative Shaw's benefit, page 12 and 13, that's 1865-682. This is the Department of Public Safety's current regulation on how they certify village public safety officers.
And I want to apologize, Representative Liu had a question. I forgot to call on her, and she was on my list. Go ahead, Representative Liu.
I'm just looking at line 15 through 17 about what the training program includes with respect to the methods of arrest, and it talks about, like, use of batons. But I notice it doesn't say anything about the use of weapons, I mean, other than, like, batons. And I'm just sort of wondering about that.
Through the chair, Representative Ledoux, the firearms training specifically is in a different statute that's on AS 6578 on page 11 of the statute is where they would get the firearms portion of that weapons training. As far as the rest of the training, we have folks online with their testimony that they can address that, specifically Mr. Nemeth, who is a village public safety officer coordinator, so he manages a VPSO program, and he can speak to that.
So there's a specific section that says weapons training, and then in addition to weapons training, you've got this training?
That's correct, through the chair. Page 14, proposed 1865-684 is the dealing with denial, revocation, and lapse of VPSO certificates. Again, this is from a current and existing DPS regulation. Finally, page 13 and 14, 1865-686. This is, we took a look at this earlier, so we don't really need to spend a whole lot of time on it, but to show that on subparagraph C up on the screen, you can see that on the search and rescue efforts, the department said that these organizations don't have the authority to manage search and rescue, and they concurred. They really just coordinate with the state on that. And here, this is answers the question about what on slide 43 about what somebody can do if they're not trained. So they can enforce the ordinances where they are to the extent that they're certified and they've got training in that area. And finally, the definition change, increasing the size of village to 2,500 from 2,000. So that's the walkthrough and the explanation of changes, Mr. Chairman.
Congratulations. You have finished the presentation. What I suggest we do before we go to questions, we go ahead and open the public hearing. We may have some people that have questions that the committee may want to ask questions to, and it's allowed us to do that. The first person we're going to call is, looks like, Captain Andrew Merrill, Alaska State Trooper. He's calling in from Seattle. Captain Merrill, can you hear us? Captain Merrill?
Sorry, Mr. Chair, can you hear me?
We can hear you now.
Okay, I apologize. I'm trying to get squared away. I'm in Seattle on a prisoner transport. So, good morning, Mr. Chairman and the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to present today. Commissioner Price was unavailable to attend, and she asked me to represent the department, so I'll be reading a brief statement that she provided, and I just have a few comments to add to that. So, if I speak too quickly, yell at me and I'll stop.
Go ahead.
So the mission of the Department of Public Safety is to ensure public safety with resources deployed throughout the state. In order to accomplish this mission, the department is committed to working with law enforcement professionals across the state, communities, lawmakers, and stakeholders to provide for greater public safety and seek opportunities to collaborate on solutions that will increase public safety. As announced in May of 2019, the VPSO Working Group was tasked with coordinating with all stakeholders to provide options to the Alaska State Legislature to structurally revamp the VPSO program. The DPS offers continued partnership in addressing all ways of improving rural public safety, not limited to one singular program. With that, there are a few things that I'll try to be as, I guess, gentle and polite as I can in most of some of the comments. And so I want to be clear that the last time I had the opportunity to represent any discussion on this bill, it was fairly new, so I did not have a lot of information. I have found that in my 5 years of working with the DPSO program, it's a lot like dropping a pebble into a lake. There are unintended consequences for some of the decisions that we've made, and we've made multiple modifications and adaptations in working in our partnership with the grantee representatives. And so it's important that we have a good, clear understanding of all the changes that are being understood. And some multiple times a day, and whether it's just misunderstanding or not having all the information, I've heard a lot of times, oh, this is current regulation. But the challenge of that is in some of those areas where we're just codifying regulation, there's been some minor changes that actually have some significant impacts. And so it's important that looking over some of the regulations, there have been minor tweaks in some of that regulation based on the input of the group. And so I would just recommend that everybody make a very concerted effort to review and make sure that those are accurate. For example, there was just one of the sections that was brought up was the waiver, the revocation section. In that section, the prior language said shall. The new language says may. That's a significant change, that drop of the pebble, and it's important that we all understand that that was a change that was made to the current regulation that changes that meaning now that it will be codified in statute. And so I don't have all those listed. I just wanted to make sure that was a general statement of some of the things. There are some concerns the department has with this. We're happy to continue to work with the bill sponsors to give our concerns and talk about challenges that exist. Some of those exist with, we'll start with the felonies. So felonies are an extreme challenge because while CJIS and Ms. Kathy Montefrida, who is our absent security specialist and the director, can speak more clearly to qualifications for CJIS access, there are some, the FBI's language did change, allowing for, very extreme circumstances for exceptions. Felonies create other challenges for us because the felony convictions, whether they disqualify or we can get an exception for the CJIS clearance, they disqualify a VPSO from having and possessing firearms. And so that means we could hire a VPSO who has a felony conviction, whether it's 10 years or older or whatever, and ultimately that VPSO, if he responds to a suicide or he responds to, say, an assault in progress where a firearm is used, if that VPSO takes possession of that firearm or ammunition, they would be committing a federal offense. And so we knowingly would be hiring people that we're going to put in situations where they may or may not have to take possession of firearms. And if they did so in the course of their business, we know they're going to be violating federal law. And so that's a concern that we have that we need to address in this conversation outside of simply talking about CJIS clearance, but also other laws that may be impacted. We have some challenges and issues. So there are also felonies that are not against a person, but also would, for example, if you have a specific felony conviction, you could be required to be a sex offender. So if you, and it's not a sex offense, so it's an unrelated crime to a sex offense where you actually sexually assaulted someone, but you receive the felony conviction, and because of that conviction, after 10 years, you still may be required to be a sex offender on the sex offender registration, but you would still, under the this regulation and bill, or under this bill, would be allowed to be a VPSO. So we need to work through some of those challenges as well. Backgrounds is also a challenge for us. In the language of the bill, it talks about backgrounds being fingerprint-based and CJIS. We currently do that. Earlier, I think it just misinformation or misunderstanding. DPS has consistently, for at least since I've been in the program since 2014, have conducted the fingerprint-based background check for VPSOs. We have never stopped doing that. We still continue to do that to this day. What we did stop doing was the more in-depth background investigation. And that consisted of calling family members and relatives, other individuals that could talk about the character of the individual that we were looking at hiring. Those, we did stop doing those background checks or those investigations earlier this last July because the grantees, those receiving the grant, we're unhappy with the amount of time it takes. And unfortunately, our backgrounds for law enforcement take a significant amount of time. They can take anywhere from 6 weeks to 5 or 8 months, depending on what background information we're trying to have. For example, we had a VPSO coming from out of country, and we had to do extensive work to get records from out of country to confirm that they didn't have any history in that country they were coming from that disqualified them. And that took time doing that. And so a background investigation versus a fingerprint-based criminal history check are two different things. And in this language, we're just not quite sure as a department whether we're being asked to do a full investigation, which is going to take time. And the grantees have expressed their concern with how much time it takes us to do a thorough background, or just the background fingerprint check, the fingerprint criminal history check, which is what we're already doing, which typically takes two to three weeks, unless there's a conviction that we then have to request that waiver for. So those are some things that we need to work through as well. Also, as part of our Alaska State Trooper background, we talk about raising the work that the VPSOs will be doing. There are challenges and questions with, okay, so if we're increasing the workload they're doing and increasing their responsibility and authority, troopers are required to do a psychological evaluation prior to hire. We're required to do a polygraph. And so the question is the intent of this bill to do the exact same kind of testing with VPSOs if they're going to have the same responsibilities and authority as troopers? And we just need to clarify those. Current language, one of the things that was highlighted, that I highlighted as well, is so current regulation, one of the, and it's also in the APSC language for police officers for the state of Alaska, there's language that talks about police officers, peace officers, and currently in VPSO regulation, they must be of good moral character. That language is completely removed in the bill, and so there's some concerns with that of if we're looking at hiring felons and other things, is a requirement to have that good moral character, and how do we figure that out? So training was talked about. I can answer questions on training. There's some challenges when we talk about domestic violence convictions. I have a list of things that I could talk about, but ultimately the department stance is we support moving the funding to commerce with the concerns that were expressed. We continue to support ongoing discussion and being involved in the process. There's questions that I could answer. I think a lot of frustration on my side comes from, I was involved in one meeting. I've been doing the program for 5 years, and this is the first time I've had the opportunity to talk about the bill other than providing information through the commissioner in a letter. So, I absolutely look forward to answering any questions and engaging this process, because the goal that we have is, and that I've had as a state trooper for the last 18 years, is improving the public safety that we provide to all Alaskans, especially in rural Alaska. I spent 5 years in Bethel, 5 years in Nome. I've traveled all around the state, and my goal is to make all of our villages and our communities safe. So I'm happy to answer any questions.
All right. I would just note that we have been hearing Captain Merrill under invited testimony because I haven't yet technically opened the public hearing. Are there questions for Captain Merrill?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Drummond.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Captain Merrill, have you considered the recommendations that were made by the commissioner to the sponsors of the bill in their letter dated March 4th, 2020?
Yes, so I participated with Commissioner Price in drafting that letter and the recommendations that were included in her letter.
Follow-up?
Representative Drummond.
And have those changes been made?
Some of the recommendations, there were some minor changes to the felony language and some of the other changes that were addressed in this version, but there are still in this version concerns that we have. And I unfortunately don't have a copy of that letter with me, so I can't word for word it because I'm sitting in CTAC. But, yes, we are happy to engage and continue to try to improve this.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
And Representative Drummond, you were talking about the March 4th letter?
Yes.
And before I go to Representative Shaw, Trooper or Captain Merrill, is the Department of Public Safety at this point supporting this bill, not supporting this bill, neutral or reservations? What is the position of the department right now in terms of this bill?
Mr. Chair, so currently the department is not supportive with the felony language and some of the other challenges that are in there, and so there need to be some changes made before the department can fully back the bill.
Okay. Representative Shaw.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Captain Merrill, a question I have as a former director for police standards is the deviation from many of the standard requirements for training and certification for the VPSO program. And the fact that a big part of my concern is, and one thing you highlighted was good moral character. And it seems like that we are deleting or diluting a number of those requirements that I see necessary under police standards for the VPSO program, so it's my concern. Would you agree or at least make a comment relative to the standards under required under Alaska Police Standards and the requirements in this bill for VPSOs?
Representative Shaw, through the chair, yes, I'd be happy to provide a little information on that. Yes, we have concerns with the ability, for example, like I said, the ability for felons to become VPSOs. That becomes a challenge not only in the academy. We have academy requirements that we are teaching people skills that subversive investigative skills sometimes that we are teaching troopers and other people who attend our academy that we don't want the general public to know. And so you have to be able to pass those requirements as well as CJIS requirements to be able to attend and be even present in the building. If anyone visits our building at headquarters, you know that you have to be escorted with one of us. Somebody has to escort you in the building. So we have those challenges. The training and the reduction is a concern. And so we think that needs to be addressed. I think the challenge is while I support the idea of increasing the stature of the VPSOs and maybe giving them some more responsibility that we in the past have not had them do, we also need the right people to do that job. There's a reason that we have troopers go through polygraphs. There's a reason that troopers go through psych evaluations. I take people's rights away. I have the authority of the state has granted me the authority, and all the troopers that work with me and for me, the authority to take people's rights away. We put them in handcuffs. We put them in cars. We can use force, and we want to make sure we're hiring the right people. And I fully understand that we are in a crisis with not being able to find people out in those communities to do that job. But we want to find the right people that can do that job appropriately and safely, with minimizing the concerns as much as possible.
Representative Shaw.
Thank you, Captain Merrill. A follow-up question that I have for the benefit of the committee relative to training, and if you could verify this, to investigate felony crimes, felony level crimes such as sexual assaults, you need training specific to that. And I see in this bill that VPSOs will be allowed to investigate felony crimes without that training for into the 24 months that they could be trained for that. And that's a comment that I'd like to have you look at, if you would. The training has to be in place if you want to investigate felonies.
Captain Merrill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Shaw, through the chair, you are correct. So Representative Kopp actually pointed out that there is the opportunity for VPSOs, and we work closely with the grantee organizations to, when they hire a VPSO, trying to clearly define what they can do prior to going to training. We have challenges with that because we have VPSOs that we hire who the community sees them as a VPSO, and they're hired as a VPSO, and the community doesn't really care if they've been to training. They want the VPSO to come take care of business. And so there's a pressure applied sometimes to VPSOs to perform duties outside of their responsibilities and their training just because of the need, which is kind of why we've ended up where we are. And so, yes, there is some concern. I don't know all the training. I've read the requirements that are listed here. It will depend if they attend the full ALIT Academy, which VPSOs since 2015 have done up until this year. They would have that required training after they leave the academy. The challenge becomes is whether they attend the full ALIT Academy, whether they're receiving the firearm training while they're there. There's still some questions. The amount of training that's listed in the bill, we're still working with the academy to figure out what that means at the academy for training. And so, but yes, that is a valid concern that you've expressed.
Thank you.
All right. I don't see any other questions in the queue. Or Representative Vance, do you have a question?
Yes, I was all just right. Trying to formulate it. Captain Merrill, in looking at the bill and also the ability of DPS to have regulation, do you feel it would be needed to define in statute what the expectation is of the grantees on on their their what they require to make to ensure that they are not putting the VPSOs out there without proper training first.
Representative Vance, through the chair, yes, I think that the when I read through the bill, there's a lot of information that talks about what the department will do and what the both Department of Commerce, Department of Corrections, and Department of Public Safety, but there's very little that talks about what the grantees and the expectations of the grantees are. And I think that it makes sense that we have it, because as the guy that's been doing this for the last 5 years, the VPSO program, I've worked very closely, and I thought that we had a great relationship with the grantees. I met with them on a quarterly basis. We made multiple changes to the grant agreement, trying to best serve the needs of each of the communities within the regulations and statutes we had. And so one of the challenges with this is that there's a lot of the department shall and the state will do, but there's not a lot of what exactly the grantee is going to provide. And so we have worked closely to try to clarify. You know, it used to be when I started in this program, we would hire a VPSO. We'd give them a baton, a taser, and a belt without even training them and put them in the village and let them work. And that was historic. I mean, it blew my mind that we were doing that. And so we changed that. And the express need of having VPSOs in the village sometimes overrides doing things safely. And so sometimes we have grantees that want to hire VPSOs who shouldn't be hired as VPSOs. And when we have VPSOs who are fully qualified, that aren't disqualified because of convictions, but when we do our background, we find information that causes a significant concern, and we used to make that recommendation. I would send a letter that said they don't have any disqualifications, and we don't recommend you hire them based on our background because we have concerns about them, and they would get hired. And a majority of the time when we made those recommendations, those VPSOs left the program under less than ideal circumstances because of behavior or other issues. And so having information that helps the department understand what we can expect of the grantees would absolutely be fair and appropriate.
Thank you.
All right. I don't see any other questions next in the queue. Looks like we've got Michael Nemeth, Village Public Safety Officer, Coordinator, he's with the program, Mr. Nemeth. And in the interest of trying to get through I'm going to open public testimony. In the interest of getting through public testimony, I'm going to ask you to limit your comments to 3 minutes, and then it's likely there'll be questions, so you'll have more than enough opportunity to provide information. Go ahead, Mr. Nemeth.
My name is Michael Nemeth. I have been a village public safety officer since the spring of 2002, and I have been the village public safety officer program coordinator for the Aleutian Pribilof Islands region since 2012. So I have 18 years with the program in the field and as a supervisor for the program. I just want to take a moment to say that I believe the bill will help officers in the field and the coordinators and grantees operate the program in a way that will provide better public safety services to people in rural Alaska. I want to thank the VPSO Legislative Work Group for all the work they did for their report in this bill. And I'd like to also thank this committee for having me. If you have any questions, please feel free.
I have a question.
Representative Stutes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Nemeth. Thank through the chair. What kind of training have you had?
Training provided by the state in 2004 when I finally went through the VPSO Academy. It was 8 weeks of training. Also, I was required to get certification to attend the Rural Fire Protection Specialist training, which was 96 hours of training. And I'm not sure what the actual hours were at the academy when I went. I'd have to dig out my certificate and take a peek at it to get those actual numbers. Also, since then, I've been certified as an emergency trauma technician, and I have multiple non-Department of Public Safety provided trainings in my 18-year career.
Hello?
Representative Suits.
Do you carry a firearm?
I do not, ma'am.
Thank you.
I don't see any other questions. Next in the queue for public testimony is David Neese, calling from Anchorage. Mr. Neese.
Yeah, hi, David Neese, speaking for myself, calling from Anchorage. House Bill 287 is a very good bill. When we were doing our budget analysis for United for Liberty, we looked at the Village Public Safety Program specifically, and we found there was a lot of room for improvement. So moving it from public safety into commerce allows commerce to oversee the actual costs of the program. It's not a huge program as far as money, but it's very important that as much money gets out into the village as possible and not be queued up by administrative costs. So to that end, if we're working on version O in section 3 on page 6 on line 35, you should follow the example that this legislature did with charter schools. In charter schools, it's the same kind of setup. You're delegating authority to a subunit, and that subunit has rules. So they decided that school district could more than 4% for administrative costs. The knockoff effect has been that the charter schools have functioned just fine, and almost all of them now have reserve accounts that are in the positive area. So if you look at that section 3, page 6, line 35, you might want to consider changing that language from 35% to somewhere between 3 and 5%. This frees up more money to actually go towards the costs. As far as the training and the firearm, I think Representative Shaw has a very good handle on that. You do want somebody out there that is trained in using firearms, somebody that's trained in conflict de-escalation. There's a lot of training that goes into your peace officers, and that's what Village Public Safety, they're your peace officer. They're your deputies for the state of Alaska. So anything we can do to improve their life and transfer more money into their pocket by getting rid of administrative costs would be a good deal. So if you could take a look at Section 3, page 6, line 35, and see if 35% is high. When we looked at it for United for Liberty, if you've got it, one of our budget books.
Mr. Neese, tell me again where you're seeing this reference.
This is in version O.
I see it. Okay, thank you. I found it. Go ahead. Continue with your testimony.
Yeah, so I just think that this program has a lot of merit to it. It's got a lot of bugs that have to be ironed out of it, but moving it out of public safety and into commerce does what it's actually doing, which is the money into the villages and the small villages and making sure that it is used mostly for public safety and less for administration of the program. I think that would be a good move. My recommendation is you look at something between 3 and 5%, as 35% means that if you have a grantee that has $100,000, $35,000 or more, is allowed to go towards administration.
Okay. Mr. Neese, you're a little past the 3 minutes. I'll give you about 5 seconds to wind up.
All right. So just to summarize, like the bill, just think you guys should take a look at possibly do an amendment on Section 3, page 6, line 35.
Line 20, that is. Thank you. Any questions for Mr. Neese? Hearing and seeing none. Next in the queue, we've got Kendra Kloster. Ms. Kloster, if you want to identify yourself and if you're affiliated with any group, then you can proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Kendra Kloster. I'm the Executive Director for Native Peoples Action and a tribal citizen of Tlingit and Haida. I am originally from Wrangell and Juneau, although I currently live in Anchorage. I am also the mother of two children who are two of my biggest reasons for being an advocate for increased public safety in Alaska. I want to express my thanks to Representative Kopp and Ken Truitt and the VPSO Working Group for making this a priority of improving our... Native Peoples Action is a statewide Alaska Native nonprofit that gives voice to our peoples and our traditional way of life by taking a stand, working together, and mobilize action. We do this through ensuring Alaska Natives are heard at all levels of policymaking. We advocate for safe communities, equal access to education, health and wellness, and our traditional ways of life. Public safety is the right of every Alaskan, and everyone has the right to feel whole, to feel safe in their community, no matter where they live, whether it's urban or rural. Safe communities has been one of our top priorities. We do a number of things at Native Peoples Action to reach out to individuals and communities across the state, whether it be surveys or emails, just phone conversations. And public safety has risen to the top. If it's not the first, it's definitely in the top three of the concerns that we're hearing. We've heard numerous times that only one in three villages have a public safety officer, and we've seen the decrease in VPSOs over the years. And we appreciate this bill because it's going to be taking care of some of the issues that have been brought forward. One of them is moving the funding to DCCED, the organization that I feel like is really the appropriate place to be managing funds, removing barriers in the statute that have hindered the program, and still allowing a lot of local control and government-to-government relationships. You know, tribes and communities really have a good feel for what's going on in those communities and really feel like this is a really great partnership that needs to continue, and hope to see in other avenues across Alaska, just working with communities on the ground and our tribes. So I just want to put forward again, thank you so much. We appreciate the work and making sure that we have more VPSOs, that we are supporting them, and hope that this committee and the legislature will support House Bill 287. Gunashish.
Thank you very much. Any questions for Ms. Kloster? Hearing and seeing none, next in the queue for testimony is Kelsey Wallace. Ms. Wallace, if you want to put your name on the record, state any affiliation, and you can proceed with your testimony.
Hello, everyone, Mr. Chair, members of the House Judiciary Committee. I just want to say thanks for this opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 287. For the record, my name is Kelsey Juvlin Wallace, and I'm originally from Bethel, Alaska, or Montreshuk. I'm Yupik, and I currently am the Communications Director for Native Peoples Action, living here on Denaina Lands in Anchorage. Today I'm calling in as a mom and a concerned family member and friend. I really commend the VPSO Working Group for their recommendations and think that this is a great first step in ensuring that we have a better public safety system for Alaska. Our communities deserve first responders no matter where they live, and currently my family members and friends don't have anybody to turn to when something happens in their community. Oftentimes they have to rely on other community members for help. And today I just really want to take a second and share a quick story of my friend Bayuk Moore. She had her home broken into this last year in Aluknagik. Bayuk was home alone when she was woken up to her window breaking. Somebody was breaking into her home. When she looked out the window, she saw a man climbing up a ladder. And even after shouting at him, shouting to him that she had a gun, he kept trying to get into her home. She shot her gun at the ground in hopes to scare him off and to buy some time to call 911. But when she called 911, she was told that they couldn't send a police officer. When she called the troopers, the dispatch was sent to Kenai, and they couldn't get a hold of the on-call trooper because he was in King Salmon. They also couldn't get a hold of the other trooper who was in Dillingham. And by the time the trooper that was on call was able to get to her in Aluknagik, she had already gotten her neighbors to respond. And those same neighbors were the ones that helped her board up her broken window, and she ended up staying with them at their house to feel safe. My friend Abayuk was an incredible single mother. She's a recognized artist, and she's a true example of a person dedicated to living and thriving in rural Alaska. Luckily, her kids weren't with her, weren't home with her at the time, but the trauma from this experience still affects her and her kids to this day. You know, what if she didn't have her neighbors come to help because she couldn't get any help? She was able to stop the rape or any physical contact that he would have inflicted by demanding and defending herself and relying on neighbors. But this isn't the case often for a lot of other people living in rural Alaska. These changes and updates to the VPA...
You're at about the three-minute mark. If you could conclude, that would be great.
Yep, I just want to say that these updates are needed, and it's literally a matter of life and safety. So I just wanted to say Koyana Jeknuk for letting me testify today in support of this bill.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions. Next is Carol Piskoya, and I'm going to shorten the time a little bit to 2.5 minutes so we can finish on schedule. Ms. Piskoya, please state your name and any affiliation.
Thank you very much. My name is Carol Piskoya. I work at Kawarik in Nome. I'm the Community Services Division Vice President, and I manage one of the programs I manage is the VPSO program. I'd like to thank you for giving me the opportunity, Mr. Chair, and the community members for speaking. I'd like to thank this working group for working so hard and time spent, all the time they have spent on this important House Bill 287. Kawarik does support this bill, but we do have concerns regarding the felony section, and perhaps that needs a little bit more research. But I also would like to say that we are very proud at Kawarik that we have 7 VPSOs currently. We are still have 8 vacancies. However, the 7 VPSOs are all from the villages that they serve in our region. So we have local VPSOs, and we constantly are recruiting and trying to encourage our local people to apply for our positions here, because they know the community, for one, and two, they live there, so they have their own housing issues. So we are working hard to try to recruit local folks for the positions. I'd also like to state that in the past, with the VPSO program, whenever Kawarik VPSO program has requested funds for additional items, in most cases we have received them, and some of the other entities have not received, but we do support giving them some flexibility in their requests for additional items that are not included in the budget. I think that was all I wanted to say, and if you have any questions, I could try to answer them. But again, thank you for giving me time and opportunity to say that we do support this House Bill 287, but have a little bit of concerns about the felonies part.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Stutes does have a question. Go ahead, Representative
Stutes. Could you
just
briefly tell me what your concerns might be about the felonies?
Pretty much the same as what Captain Merrill had stated earlier.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. I don't see any other questions. Next in the queue is Martha Whitman Kasich. Ms. Kasich, if you would state your name and any affiliation.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Martha Whitman Kasich. I'm a program administrator for the Association of Village Council Presidents in Bethel, Alaska. I have oversight over the VPSO program, which is in ABCP's Community Services Division. Our VPSO director is Alvin Jimmy. ABCP is a tribal consortium with 56 federally recognized tribes as members. We are located in southwest Alaska with 48 villages along the Kuskokwim and Yukon Rivers and the Bering Sea coast. Our service area is the same size as the state of Washington. There is a well-documented public safety crisis in rural Alaska. ABCP's tribes have prioritized public safety as the number one priority for ABCP. Public safety is a right of all Alaskans, rural and urban. There are many components of rural public safety. The VPSO program is one component of public safety, and it is one that works well when the program is supported. Tribes in our region want VPSOs. They know how effective it is to have a VPSO in their community. The VPSO Tribal Caucus, which is made up of the 10 contractors that oversee the VPSO grant, has been working together to strengthen the VPSO program. We have created a strategic plan and vision for the program. AVCP wants to thank the Alaska VPSO Legislative Working Group for listening to our recommendations and taking to heart the needs of residents of rural Alaska. House Bill 287, Village Public Safety Officer Grants, reflects many of the concepts we support to strengthen the VPSO program and deliver the public safety services that our communities deserve. This bill supports a collaborative working relationship between us, the people operating the programs in our villages, and the state of Alaska. Tribes and tribal organizations in Alaska have decades of experience in operating successful social service as well as health programs, and are experts in providing services in remote, rural, and hard-to-reach communities. We would like to thank the House Tribal Affairs Committee, the VPSO Legislative Working Group, and the Tribal Caucus for their support of rural Alaskans. Oyana.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions. Next in the queue is Daryl Hildebrand, calling from Fairbanks. Mr. Hildebrand, please state your name and any affiliation.
Hi, good afternoon, and thanks for having me. This is Daryl Hildebrand. I work for Tanana Chiefs Conference as the VPSO coordinator. I just wanted to let you guys know that we do support HB 287, especially with the changes, amended changes that's made. I would like to thank the Legislative Working Group for working so hard with the caucus and with the VPSO grantees to make these changes, much needed changes for rural Alaska. I have been in law enforcement for 21 years, and in all my years of viewing the VPSO program, I have never seen changes such as this. And it's a positive, I believe it's a positive change that needs to happen, that needs, the villages need to see to continue on with the VPSO program so that we're not in the same position 20 years from now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. That's all that I show online. We have one person in the room that's signed up to testify, Vicki Jo Kennedy. Ms. Kennedy.
I know the drill. Vicki Jo Kennedy. My home is still Kodiak Island, but I'm still here in Juneau. And I guess I'll only be in the building till 5 o'clock tonight, because then we're kicked out. I'm a little upset of a lot of things going on here today on Friday the 13th, but how appropriate. And back to the BPSOs. I was in D.C. when our two BPSOs were shot and killed over here in Hoonah. That was a tragedy. It was a horrible thing that happened. But it was a mixed bag. You talk to the people, and they tell a different story from what the troopers wrote in their reports. But we do need the BPSOs, and they do have to be local, or it's just not going to work. But I find it a little hard today, especially, that I'm going to be listening to a bunch of lawbreakers in a building that we've elected to put in this building, and now they're kicking us out of a building, and they're also passing laws, because you heard my testimony yesterday, I'm sure, about the PFDs. I will see some people go out of this building in handcuffs, because stealing the people's money is against the law. Now, I know I'm off target here, but I want to voice my opinion right now before I have to leave this building, because at 5 o'clock, the public is no longer allowed in here. So if you're that afraid of the public, you need to shelter in place.
Ms.
Do
Kennedy?
Not let me see
okay,
you at the
Ms.
bars and rest. I know the rules. I'm out. I'm taking myself out of the building. Thank you.
You're welcome to continue testifying about the VPSO bill. Is there anyone else in the room who'd like to provide public testimony? Hearing and seeing no one. Oh, please come forward. We try to get people to sign up so we know you're here, and I didn't have you on the list. Please state your name and the affiliation you may have, and you can proceed.
My name is Chris Hatch. I work for the Copper River Native Association as a VPSO coordinator and a VPSO. Copper River Native Association strongly supports this bill. We do have a couple of concerns similar to Kowarik with the standards, but as a bill overall, we support it completely. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'm available for anything.
Thank you very much. I don't see any questions. Thank you for being brief. Is there, he would have gotten earlier if he'd signed up.
Yeah.
Is there anyone else in the room who'd like to provide public testimony? I hear and see no one, and I see no one else on the queue online to provide public testimony, so the public hearing this matter is closed. It is my sense that because we really haven't had a lot of chance for the committee to have a little bit more robust discussion of the bill, that we will hold this bill and continue review next week. And with that, we will adjourn for the day. Our next meeting is Monday, March 16 at 1 p.m. I'm hoping that we will have time to continue our discussion about this bill at that time. And with that, we will stand adjourned. My clock shows it is 3:01 p.m. Everyone have a nice weekend.